Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour here on WFMU, Freeform Station of the Nation, live from downtown Jersey City in that great state of New Jersey. Happy to be here with you. And I really appreciate you spending your time listening, whether you're live or in the future, listening to an archive or podcast version. Welcome. Welcome to all of you. Tonight, I am doing a listener questions episode. I've done this once before. At some point last year, I did a listener questions episode, and it went well enough that I thought it's been enough months that we should do it again. There's probably some questions out there in the listening audience that I can take on and maybe shed some light on, or not. I mean, you can be the judge of that. So for the last two shows that I did, I have been soliciting questions from listeners to email me either audio of their question or text to email them to me. And if, by the way, if you ever want to email me, my email address is mark@wfmu.org. That's mark@wfmu.org. And I ended up with 8 questions, which I think I'm going to have time to get through this evening. And I want to thank everyone who took the time to send in a question. I think I have, let me see, I have 3 audio and I have 5 in text. And so the idea is I will read out the question, then I'll give my best answer. And then on the comment board, you can correct me or add your own answer. Maybe you want to add another pointer or another point of view, or maybe you just disagree. Mark, you're wrong. And you're welcome to put any of these on the comment board. If you want to join in the live listener chat, go to wfmu.org and click playlist and comments. There's a bunch of commenters chatting away already, ready to take on their responses to my answers to your questions, if that makes sense. And if you're listening in the future to a podcast or archive version, you can find the live listener chat, which will no longer be live in the future, but you can see what everyone said, what everyone typed, if you click on the playlist link. Go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and find the playlist link by the June 17, 2024 episode, and it's all there. And as always, I've tried to put in a few entertaining little graphics on the playlist page, so if you're not interested in what I'm talking about, you can feast your eyes. Just feast your eyes on the visual smorgasbord. Actually, there's not that many images, but there's a couple. Kind of interesting. Okay. Shall we get started? I want to start with Station Manager Ken Friedman, who emailed me a few questions. One of them was a reminder, that, and I'm glad that he gave me this. I said last week at the beginning of the show, I said, maybe by the end of the show, I will tell you what my favorite robot is. Because the previous week, that is now 2 weeks ago now, Matt Warwick, DJ Matt Warwick, was generous enough to guest host Tectonic, and he did a live call-in show asking listeners, what is the best robot? And so I thought I should weigh in. So let me go ahead and weigh in. I thought about this a lot, and I came up with a few candidates that I think, I mean, I liked a lot of the robots that were mentioned 2 weeks ago during Matt's show. If you didn't hear that show, by the way, it's great. Matt does such a good job as a live call-in host, better than I am at taking live phone calls. I did that in the early year or two of Tectonic, and I think Matt just has a special talent for that. Anyway, you can go back and listen. Everyone had some really interesting suggestions of what is the best robot. And I have a few that I think, you can correct me, but I think none of these were mentioned by listeners during that call-in show. Number one, this isn't my favorite necessarily, but one that I thought deserved a mention is, as a child of the 80s, a Gen Xer, I have to go with R2-D2. I know maybe it's a little cliche, and I don't know, I don't keep up with all the Star Wars spin-offs, and you know, I know there was some sort of a baby Yoda thing. There's probably a baby R2-D2 cartoon out there by now. I'm not interested in all the new stuff. I'm just talking about the original three movies. And R2-D2 was, you know, he was helpful but unobtrusive. He had some skills, but he was not using them to exploit any of the humans. He was just there as a helper. And that is the ideal robot. One that's going to be a helper, unobtrusive, and just not get in the way and not do deceptive, underhanded things when we're not looking, which seems to be the business model of the big tech companies and anything that they create. So I want to give a little credit to that little trash can, that animated trash can, R2-D2. I don't know if this counts as a robot, but speaking of influential science fiction movies, I don't think anyone mentioned HAL 9000 from 2001. Now, I know, HAL 9000 may not count as a robot. It was a disembodied AI with a voice, and it's saying, spoiler, it's saying Dolly at the end. But was it a robot? I don't know, but maybe in a way, because it was controlling physical, you know, the airlock and different things. It had control of physical and mechanical systems, so maybe that... Maybe systemic. It was kind of a systemic robot. Anyway, HAL 9000, sort of the opposite of R2-D2. A little obtrusive, a little underhanded. If you've seen the movie, I won't give it all away. If you haven't seen it, another one from the 80s. Why are these all 80s? 80s children references. I don't know. But another one that I thought of. I don't think anyone brought up. Did you ever watch back in the 80s? If you were there then, did you ever watch that Lee Majors TV show called The $6 Million Man? I remember I was a little kid. I forget if I was 8 or 10 or something like that. I was in grade school. There was a robot. I had to look this up because I haven't seen the show in, I don't know, 40 years or something. But there was a robot that was terrifying to me at that age. And I looked it up, and I never knew the name. It's called the Death Probe. Do you remember this? The Death Probe? The $6 million, it only showed up in a few episodes, but the $6 million man, I guess they needed a worthy opponent because he was a superhuman cyborg that had super strength, super speed, and all of that. And so apparently there was some, it was in the midst of the Cold War, so there was some Soviet equals bad guy probe that landed from outer space. And it was this robot, it was like this conical section that it was on wheels, and it had different attachments that it would grab him, and it would have a rotating blade, and it had a little heat laser that it could shoot at the $6 million man, and it made this terrifying whine, this noise. Oh, I really didn't like that. Anyway, that was the Death Probe. That was not the best robot, but a very memorable robot. And then another one that I think is worth looking into, no one mentioned, I don't think, is the Golem of Prague. Have you heard of the Golem of Prague? This is from several hundred years ago. It's an old Jewish legend of a essentially a robot, a man-made sentient, I guess, being, and it would the rabbi would feed it some characters. Some Hebrew characters, and it would go out and accomplish a mission. It was a little bit like, you know, the hardware is there, and it's waiting for the software to go to give it instructions for what to do. It's well worth reading up on. If you're interested in robots, make sure you read up on the Golem of Prague. Then, finally, I'll say what the best robot is, I think, and I don't think anyone mentioned this, Frankenstein's Monster. As depicted in the novel Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, that is one of the most influential books. If you are interested in technology studies, technology criticism, you have to read Frankenstein and the monster, not the Boris Karloff version, okay, not the one in the movies, but the literary monster. As Mary Shelley wrote it, it has a lot to say about where we are today. And if you were interested in some of that analysis, read Brian Merchant's book, Blood in the Machine. Brian was on the show. You can find his interview in the archives. We didn't talk about Mary Shelley, but there's a whole section about Mary Shelley and the writing of Frankenstein in that book. So that's the best robot, Frankenstein's monster. Ken continues, can you mention several use cases of robots or AI that you feel are new and positive? Because I'm often going on a tear about criticism about technology. Let me just say that there are many positive uses for AI and robotics. It's just that those often get most of the media coverage out in the technology press, and I feel like to balance the scales, I am trying to raise the alarm about downsides, about possible harms that are going to come from these technologies that are not getting very much coverage at all. With that said, this is a valid question. Where are there some positive use cases of robots and AI? I mean, generally, I think we can say robots for medical uses, robots in surgery. I haven't done a show on this. I haven't done a lot of reading, so I'm very much a layman in this aspect of robotics. But it seems to me like robots in surgery are making great advances, and they're giving surgeons much more precision, and they're making the surgeries much less invasive. Our arthroscopic surgeries are often being done by robots, as I understand it. That is all good. I mean, robotics can be used for great, great things. The problem is when a surgery robot is then taken over by someone like Elon Musk, who says, I want to put chips in everyone's brain so that we can meld with the global AI that I want to build. That's when it goes a little bit off into the reality distortion field that Musk always carries with him, and things get loopy and a little bit dangerous. But if it's being done for legitimate medical purposes to actually help people and heal them and address real health concerns, I think that's really good. There's other uses that I could list off for robots and AI, but I just wanted to focus on that one to say, that is all good, and I'm fully behind that, and I hope that there is much more development and in advancement in robotics where it can actually be helpful for people. Ken finally asks, was there one moment when you realized that the internet was turning to the dark side? Yes. Over the years, it's been a gradual process, of course, as I've told the story a number of times since I started out online in the mid-90s, just after the web was born. Everything was idealistic. Things changed little by little, but really where there was a great acceleration of the bad vibes was right after the financial crash of 2008-2009. And I have read this in books and articles in my research for the show. There have been other people who have verified this for me, that was a very important moment in the history of Silicon Valley, was 2009. And the reason is, a lot of the finance bros who had been involved in the underhanded dealings of Wall Street that caused the financial crash in 2008-2009, after the crash, they saw that there was limited opportunity for them to do what they like to do on Wall Street. And so many of them moved out to California, sensing correctly that there were money in those hills in Silicon Valley, and they brought their Wall Street practices to the big tech firms. And that was the moment when big tech, it was already, as I said, it's already in process to some extent, but that was a great acceleration of the financialization of Silicon Valley and the embrace of the growth at any cost ethos was in the wake of the financial crash, because the Wall Street talent, if you can call it that, relocated from New York over to Northern California and began to run their tricks out inside the walls of Google and Facebook and Amazon and Apple and Uber and everybody else. And that sidelined a lot of the engineers, many of whom had good product sense or maybe even some ethics, would not be willing to exploit people to quite such an extent. But once the bros came in and tech bro culture established itself, everything changed. And as far as I can tell, that originated on Wall Street, and now it is firmly ensconced in Silicon Valley and continues to partner with those same types on Wall Street today. So that I would say 2008, 2009 was a great turning point. There were other turning points. There were other moments when things got even darker and darker, and I had some grim realizations, but that was one of them. So thank you, Station Manager Ken, for those questions. I'm going to move on now to the second question, and this is going to be our first audio question. This comes from a longtime listener and friend of the show, Handy Haversack. Go ahead, Handy.
Hi, Mark. Handy Haversack here. Thanks for taking listener questions. And I'm sure it must be a relief to you to get a question from me instead of another torrent of a chat board statement. But then again, screeds and jeremiads are always in at Tectonic. My question is about spy phones, as all right-thinking people call them. You have said on air that you have an Apple spy phone, despite the major issues with privacy and security that that entails. So my question is kind of twofold. What aspect of the so-called convenience that spy phones offer keeps you on the hook, so to speak? And what might it take to get you off? Would something have to change in your life? Or is there a further line that spy phones could cross that would get you off of them forever? Thanks for everything, Mark. As ever, I look forward to the best hour on the best radio station on Earth.
All right. Thank you, Handy. Thank you for those kind words about the show. And of course, I agree with you about the station, best ever. And great question. Great question. What would it take to get me off of the Apple spy phone, also known as the iPhone? Funny how spy phone includes the sound of iPhone. iPhone. Anyway, what would it take me? Well, let me just tell you what my current usage of my surveillance phone is day to day. I don't have any social media apps on my phone, so I'm not. There's not a lot for me to check moment to moment. Actually, I find my phone to be rather boring, and I'd like it to stay that way. So I don't use it a whole lot, except for texting. I'm for a variety of other things that I have going on outside the show. There are reasons why I need to be in touch on text, and often it's good for me to be able to receive a photograph via text, or even to send a photograph via text. Okay, so what I would like, and what would get me to switch off of the Apple surveillance phone, is I would need something that had a strong texting feature. I mean, that's a pretty solid requirement on my side in order to maintain the relationships and the communication channels that I have in my life. And what I would also like is for the alternate phone to have less surveillance of me and my location and so on, my activities. Less surveillance than what the Apple surveillance phone already has built in. Okay, so if I could have strong texting and less surveillance, I'd be willing to make a jump. Now, about 2 or 3 years ago, I can't remember, I had the co-founder of the Lite phone here on the show. He was live in studio. You can go back and listen in the archives to that interview if you haven't heard it. And I think it was shortly after that interview, I went out and I bought a Lite phone and I tried it out and I liked it and I still have it. I like the Lite phone. It's a de-Googled phone that just basically makes calls and texts and that's it. But here's the thing about the Lite phone. First, the texting isn't quite as good as an Apple surveillance phone. It's pretty good, but it didn't, for example, didn't have any photographic capability. So I couldn't send or receive photographs. I know they have a new version of the Lite phone coming out, but this is the Lite phone that I've got. But here's, I think, more to the point, is that the Lite phone, I think, has just about the same amount of surveillance as I'm already getting from the Apple surveillance phone. And that is because the Apple surveillance phone communicates with the cell towers, which can triangulate my location 24 hours a day, and they can package that up and sell that off to data brokers. If I use the Lite phone, same thing. In fact, if I went and I got a Linux-based phone, you might remember, listeners might remember a few weeks ago, I spoke to quote-unquote Peter, not his real name, but a security expert living in Switzerland. We talked about switching to Linux on computers and a little bit we talked about on phones. And I believe, and someone on the comment board can correct me, but I believe that even a Linux-based phone is going to give away your location based on its checking in constantly with cell phone towers. Now, when I first got a cell phone back in the 1990s, this was not as big a deal. Of course, cell towers knew where I was, but there wasn't such a robust and enthusiastic industry of data brokers who were packaging up my information in a dossier and collating it with other personal data that other data brokers were picking up and then selling that off to advertisers and who knows, governments and who knows who else. That whole surveillance ad tech stack was not built in the 1990s. And so it was less of a problem, honestly, to have a phone checking in with cell towers. These days, if you have any kind of cell phone, you're being tracked. Your location is being tracked. And so this is what I'm coming back with, Handy. The way I use my Apple surveillance phone does not throw off a lot of surveillance data because I'm not using it for very much. But what it does throw off, I don't like, but I don't know how to avoid that with other phones. So I'm not sure. I would like to get off of the Apple surveillance phone, but I'm not sure if there is a real improvement that's available for me. If anybody knows, on the comment board, you can post it or you can email me at mark@wfmu.org. I might be just missing something obvious. But I want to say one other thing about this topic about switching that Handy is asking about, because I think there's a larger point here that we should, I believe we should, in principle, we should be looking for ways to extract ourselves, to extricate ourselves from the grips of big tech and its terrible business models, its unethical practices, and its very, very sticky fingers on all of our personal data. We should be looking for ways to exit that ecosystem, if you can call it that. Let me just say it again. We should be looking for ways to exit the toxic sludge factory that is Silicon Valley. And while in my case, the phone, I don't have an easy way to see how I can improve my life with a different phone. On the other hand, I can see other ways that I could do a better job of extricating myself from big tech. For example, by getting off of the Apple surveillance laptop that I use. And so at some point, I might look into switching to Linux on a laptop and start moving myself step by little step by little step into Linux. So this is all to say, I'm not saying that I am done and I feel totally fine about where I am. I'm just saying we're on a journey, if we want to, of getting ourselves off of big tech. We're all at different points of our journey and we all have different challenges and we all have different next steps. For me, it's probably my laptop, which is my next step. For someone else, it might be, you know, a good first step might be to get off of Instagram. Or you know what, a very first step, even if you don't want to delete your Instagram account, maybe a good first step is just delete the app. Just delete the social media apps from your surveillance phone. You can still use them on a laptop elsewhere, but then you're not walking around like a phone zombie looking at your phone rather than the people and the environment around you when you're out in public. So, Handy, you bring up a very good point about asking where are we? What can we do to live a healthier life with technology? It's going to be a different answer for everybody, and I hope you I have given you some sense of where I am in my journey, and it's not done, and I have a lot of work to do. So I'm certainly far from where I should be, but you know, I would just encourage everybody, look at one baby step that's right for you that you can choose to do in the next, I don't know, week. And then report back. See how it feels and report back. Come back in the comment board and tell us what you did. So, Handy, thanks for that question. Let's go to our next audio question. This comes from listener Emily. Go ahead, Emily.
Hi, Mark. My name is Emily Polak-Slovak on the listener chat. My husband, Jan, and I have been avid listeners to your fabulous show over the past few years. We always love listening to Tectonic. It's something we look forward to. Even if we can't tune in live, since we live in London, we always go back to the playlist to catch up on what we've missed. We recently had a baby. He just turned 6 months old, and an episode which is burned in my mind is the episode with Susan Lynn. Anyways, are you planning to do another full-length episode about the cross-section of childhood and technology? It is an endless topic, but sharing resources and ideas would be fantastic. Always appreciate your show, Mark. Keep doing what you do. Take care.
And that was listener Emily. Emily, thank you so much for your kind words. Congratulations on the new addition to the family, and thanks for listening from London. That's a great question about kids and technology. I agree. I mean, I'm a parent myself, and it has been an area of interest for me over the years to try to figure out how to raise a child in an increasingly dangerous technological society. When I say dangerous, I mean dangerous and risky for kids. Because the fact is, as Susan Lynn brought up in the interview a few months ago, it's just a wild west. These companies are just running rampant, releasing exploitative software and platforms with dark patterns and all sorts of deceptive schemes, trying to get kids hooked, even addicted, on their platforms. And it has caused all sorts of harms. There's a book by Jonathan Haidt out called The Anxious Generation that I haven't covered on the show, but that would be if and when I do a show on kids and technology, I would certainly refer to that. There's also a piece by Jean Twenge. She wrote a book a few years ago called iGen, I-G-E-N. I think that's now probably 5 years old, that book. And she has been doing a lot of research on the effect of online technology on kids these days. Twenge, by the way, is T-W-E-N-G-E. I spotted a piece that she wrote for the magazine National Review. And it just lists all of the harms that that Silicon Valley technology is probably causing for teens and even younger kids, and makes some suggestions on what to do next. And so I could probably do a show just diving into Haidt's and Twenge's research. By the way, one of the things that Twenge says, if you want a quick tip, which I completely agree with, and I believe Susan Lynn said the same thing, is very simple. Don't give your kid a smartphone until they are at least 13 years old. And there are a lot of parents, and there are some grassroots organizations here in the U.S. that are starting up to encourage parents to adopt that as a family policy. No smartphones until age 13. By the way, there's plenty of phones out there to give kids to keep in touch with them, you know, to make say, okay, I'm leaving school, or can you come pick me up, or whatever. That's totally fine. And in fact, for my own son, DJ Paradox, I gave him a flip phone, and if longtime listeners remember this, he was on the show when he was just a little kid, talking about his experience being the only kid in his grade. I forget what grade he was in. He was in like fifth grade or something. He was the only kid in his grade without a smartphone, without a surveillance phone. He was the only one with a flip phone. And I did feel kind of bad for him, but, you know, he got over it. And he has a surveillance phone now. That'd be worth some conversation. But anyway, don't give kids a surveillance phone until age 13. Keep them on a flip phone or some of the specialty phones that are made for kids that just have phone calls and texting as the avail. Or maybe get them a light phone, you know? Get them a light phone. That's basically the same idea. And some schools, by the way, are beginning to ban surveillance phones altogether in the classroom and throughout the school during the school day. Kids show up at school, they have to put their phones, their surveillance phones, in a Faraday bag. That is something that's coated with metal, so it has no data coming in or out. And they get them back at the end of the day. And that's the policy. I think that is brilliant and should be adopted by all schools, all elementary and middle schools, immediately. If I could wave a magic wand, that would happen. One other thing I want to say about kids, quote unquote, and technology is where this leads later in life. And Emily, I know this is a number of years out in the future for you with a 6-month-old, but it's worth saying, just as we look at the whole sweep of this problem of how technology is affecting the up and coming generations, is that technology use is really affecting the kids who are now in college, who are now college age. So these are the kids, sometimes they're called digital natives, as though they're so tech savvy. They grew up with technology. Actually, it's a little bit different from that. The so-called digital natives are the ones who have been exploited by Silicon Valley their entire lives. And now we're seeing the ravages of the growth at any cost business models on these young people in college. And I don't know if you saw in the New Yorker back in February of last year, this is February 27, 2023, there was a piece in the New Yorker by Nathan Heller called The End of the English Major. Worth reading. And I won't get into all of it. I just want to read you one quote from Harvard English professor Amanda Claybaugh. Professor Claybaugh says, quote, "The last time I taught," this is at Harvard, okay? So Harvard English professor talking about her students, her Harvard students. Quote, "The last time I taught the Scarlet Letter, I discovered that my students were really struggling to understand the sentences as sentences, like having trouble identifying the subject and the verb." Okay, so make of that what you will. These are Harvard students. Presumably, they would be advanced enough when they enter Harvard College to know the difference between a subject and a verb. These are grammatical concepts that are generally taught in what grade? Fourth grade. And this is not to, this is, I don't think the idea here was to diminish these Harvard students. I think it was, the point was, if one of our better universities, one of our better undergraduate universities, is having trouble finding students who can parse a simple English sentence, a simple, you know, scarlet letter, 19th century literature sentence, what does that mean for this entire generation? And so if we look at the parents of young children today who are trying to decide whether to give their kids an addictive surveillance phone, I would just say, look at what's happened for kids who have been set upon by these big tech companies for their entire lives. Look at what that has yielded. Real problems in their cognitive abilities, at least with literature, and that should give even more motivation for parents not to give their young kids surveillance phones, at least until age 13 or later. Okay, thank you, Emily, for that excellent question. Let's go on to the third and final audio question. This is a very short one from Anonymous. Go ahead, Anonymous.
Quick question, friends and fellow Markoids. Has anyone found any countermeasures against the incipient newer car surveillance systems?
Okay, thank you, Anonymous. Has anyone found any countermeasures against the incipient newer car surveillance systems? Now, I did mention this on a, I don't know if it was the Outrage Roundup or some other roundup a few months ago, about the surveillance that's being that is going on in newer model cars. And by the way, I think it was the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the EFF, that ran this privacy audit of the major car companies, and all of them had some kind of surveillance. But there was one company that stood above all others, or perhaps beneath, depending on how you look at it. Basically, one car company had more surveillance by far than any other. Can you guess who it was? If you didn't listen to the show, if you said Tesla, you'd be right. It was Tesla. Tesla has more surveillance of the people inside the car, outside the car, around the car. A Tesla car is a surveillance machine on wheels. That's what it is. But I'm not going to get into Tesla right now. I want to note that. And it goes down from there. Nissan had this weird privacy policy. I don't know if it's still active, but Nissan said that they want to know about your sexual activity. And that's data that they could be picking up from their surveillance systems in the car. Just like, what? Where do you come from? What is your angle here? What is your problem? What is your problem? Is the question I want to ask these car manufacturers. What is the matter with you? Gosh. It's an obvious question, totally reasonable, that Anonymous brings up. What do we got to do as countermeasures? If you have a newer model car, how do you turn this stuff off? And actually, there is from the EFF, they're doing a good job here. Electronic Frontier Foundation, that's EFF.org. And on March 15, 2024, Thorin Klosowski wrote a piece called How to Figure Out What Your Car Knows About You and Opt Out of Sharing When You Can. Long headline, but very descriptive of the piece, if you read it. How to Figure Out What Your Car Knows About You and Opt Out of Sharing When You Can. That's an important phrase there, when you can, because you can't always opt out of the surveillance systems of these cars. I found another piece, and I'm going to get into it, but just as a digression, there was a piece by Ronnie Molla, R-A-N-I-M-O-L-L-A, on a site called Sherwood, which I don't know too much about. But it was an interesting story called How to Escape Honda's Privacy Hell. This is from May 6, 2024. And this is someone who actively tried to turn off the surveillance in their new model Honda. Mola talked to Misha Rykoff at the Mozilla Foundation and asked, what can these car companies collect? Rykoff says, pretty much everything. Sex life data, biometric data, demographic, race, sexual orientation, gender, everything. Did you know your car company wants to know what your sexual orientation is? Yeah, why not? Because that's data they can monetize. They put it into your dossier, sell it off to data brokers. That's money, baby. Surveillance is money. You think Facebook and Google are the only ones spying on you? Oh, no, no, no. Wherever there is big tech-infused services, such as cars, there's going to be surveillance. Mass surveillance. Monetization is the main order of the day for digital technology. It didn't have to be this way. And with proper regulation, it wouldn't be this way. But in this unregulated, growth at any cost, toxic sludge, big tech dominated economy of ours, we are at the mercy of these companies that want to surveil us until the ends of the earth. Even when you get in a car, they want to know every intimate thing about you so that they can bundle it up and sell it and make some money. They don't just want to make money selling cars. Come on, how old-fashioned are you? They want them to be surveillance machines. Okay, so what happened with this, the Sherwood story, is that it took a month for the author to even try to turn off the new surveillance, because it took that long to do the research into the privacy policy and the various systems on the car, all of which were trying to dissuade the author from turning off the surveillance. There are all sorts of dark patterns in the interface. So anyway, back to the EFF story by Thorin Klosowski, March 15, 2024. Klosowski writes that cars can share diagnostic data, your location, your daily driving habits, maintenance status, and they can share, and as well as everything else that I was talking about before, gender, sexual orientation, all that stuff, all of which can be shared with advertisers, data brokers, insurance companies, and law enforcement. Okay, so all of your private data when you get in a car is being taken down and can be shared with everyone, governmental and corporate. And there's not much distinction between the two. I'm gonna be covering this in some upcoming shows. Corporate surveillance is government surveillance. Government surveillance is corporate surveillance these days. So how do you turn it off? Well, there's no silver bullet. The EFF story says, first you got to research what exactly the car company admits to surveilling you with. So you got to see, is there a privacy policy that you can read? I mean, if you can believe it, you got to read through that. You got to look through all the documentation. Then you got to look in your car's apps and infotainment system, whatever you got on the dashboard, whatever that digital dashboard is, and you got to go deep to go into all the settings and to see what, if any, privacy options there are. And then you can turn everything off, but then you may still need to file an official privacy request with the car maker. Good luck with that. And then finally, you may also need to check for your data that came from your car on popular data broker sites that are known to share data with insurance companies. And so you got to be begging the car company to stop spying. You got to beg the data brokers to stop sharing your information. You got to beg the dashboard full of dark patterns to try to please turn off the privacy. You understand, none of these groups are incented to turn off the surveillance. You're coming at them saying, please make less money, that's what they hear you say. When you say, stop spying on me in my own car, all they hear is, please make less money. So they're going to try to dissuade you or make it complicated. Everything that, you know, Facebook and Google have perfected over the years with terms and conditions that make no sense. So good luck with that. That's what I take away from the EFF story. Good luck. But all of us should probably try it anyway. I mean, honestly, what we need is better regulation. Okay, so quickly, we have about 10, 15 minutes. By the way, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host for the remaining 15 minutes of the show, and then Dave Mantle comes on with It's Complicated, his prog rock show. Right now, in the balance of time, I am trying to get through listener questions. We've got four more. This is going to be the lightning round. Okay, friends, this is going to be the lightning round. They're all in text. I'm going to see if I can push through. No more audio breaks for me from here on out. Okay, question number 5 out of 8 comes from longtime listener, friend of the show, Herb.NYC, who writes, Mark, people make video calls all the time. I see it so often while walking outside. In reference to your shows about technology's electric footprint, that is to say the power and the carbon footprint because of the power draw of these data centers and all the other digital devices out there, Herb says, I'm guessing these video calls add up. But is it enough for us to stop doing it, meaning to stop having video calls altogether? And the question here is, and this is me now, this is my interpretation of the question, what should we do if we see that one of our habits is contributing to the outsized carbon footprint of the digital sphere on Earth? Okay, right now we had a show last fall about this, about the energy and resources draw of digital, and it was something like 10 to 15% of all power on Earth is now being used for digital uses, whether it's data centers or charging your iPad or streaming a Netflix movie or whatever. And it's just going up exponentially. So knowing that your video call is contributing in a small way to climate change, what should we do? This is my own interpretation. Should we throw our phone in the river, metaphorically? Or should we take it down to the Lower East Side Ecology Center and recycle it as e-waste? It's a difficult question, Herb. It's a good question, but it's a difficult question. And I think, once again, everybody has to make their own individual decision. I think about it, speaking of climate change, I think about this a lot when I go to, and I'll do this very often, but occasionally I'll go eat at a fast casual restaurant. not exactly fast food, but, you know, you go get a salad bowl or a grain bowl or something, okay? And you walk out and you eat it in the park or something. And then after 10, 15 minutes of eating lunch, you're left with this plastic container. Now, some of them, of course, have recyclable materials, but a lot of fast casual dining that you come out with plastic. Some places may still use styrofoam, I don't know. But these things that, you know, when you throw them away, they're going to be in a landfill for the next 10,000 years. And so the question is, when you make a small decision like that to go get a grain bowl that's going to generate a little bit of trash that's going to last forever in a landfill, do you then say, I'm no longer eating at that restaurant ever again? It's a difficult question. I mean, yes, it contributes to the climate issue, whether it's pollution, landfills, carbon footprint. Everybody has to make their own decision. Personally, I don't do video calls with my phone walking down the street. As I said before, I don't use my phone for very much. But everyone has to make their own decision. However, I will say this. These are all individual decisions, and there's a whole other category of decision. And that is the collective decision. What can we do collectively? And I think that's where really we can make some headway against these issues is if we have better regulation against the tech giants. We're beginning to get some very exciting antitrust action from the government right now, from Lina Khan's Federal Trade Commission and from the DOJ, the Department of Justice. Both of them are launching really important antitrust lawsuits against all the big tech companies. I'm really happy to see that. If you can imagine regulation like that, really taking on the technology industry and doing something about its runaway use of our electricity, our water, our other resources, it could be something really interesting. You know, on the show a couple weeks ago, the guest said that in his neighborhood in London, they're not building any more housing units because all the power is being drained down by the local data center. See, that's not right. And so collectively, we can do something about this. And we may also want to make individual decisions to have habits that we feel better about individually. And that's up to you. Thank you, Herb. Question 6 from listener Bill. I recently heard someone making the following point about students using AI to write their term papers. He compared AI to calculators. Back in the day, you could fail an algebra class for even bringing a basic pocket calculator into the class. Eventually, though, high-end scientific calculators became a requirement for almost every college-level science and math class. Today, it's rare to meet a younger person who can do basic calculations in their head. But it hasn't impacted the world in any major way. So this guy was saying AI doing the students' term papers will change the world, but in the end, it won't really make a difference. What do you think? Will AI change people in a fundamental way, but not change the world a bit? Okay, so basically saying, is AI like ChatGPT, is that the same as a graphing calculator? So students now no longer have to take out a pencil to find out the answer to 678 times 234. Okay, they can just type it in and get the answer. And, you know, there probably is some benefit to knowing how to multiply and divide and do some other operations. But in the end, it's probably not so terrible if kids walk around with calculators because they're not being de-skilled in some super important skill. You know, the lack of ability to pull out a pencil and do long division is not going to impact the world negatively that much. On the other hand, I don't think I would say the same thing about AI and ChatGPT. You know, ChatGPT wants to write a term paper. Student says, I don't need to read the Scarlet Letter. I'll have my term paper written by ChatGPT and I'll just turn it in. And we see from that Harvard professor I quoted earlier what's happening due to students being de-skilled in a much more important activity, which is reading and critical thinking. So we have to think, when we adopt new technologies, what is the skill that we're losing? Okay, long division? Okay, maybe that's acceptable. Critical thinking? No, 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 no. We need the new generations to maintain and to develop their ability to read, to write, to communicate, and to think critically about the world. What a terrible loss if we de-skill the next generation of that way. So I agree with you, Bill, that the calculators and ChatGPT, that's a false equivalency. So thank you for the question. Listener Michael, are humans predisposed to adopt novel tools at the expense of the outgroup? Basically, what Michael is saying is it always the case that the novel tool throughout history is adopted by one group and is then used to exploit a weaker group? And this is the lightning round, so my short answer is it has happened quite a bit. Again, go back to the movie 2001, when the ape picks up the bone and uses that as a club. The movie was making a point about technology and exploitation, but it doesn't always have to be that way. You know, the great thing about the ideal of a democracy is that power is not fully centralized as it is in a dictatorship, an authoritarian system that believes might is right. You know, in a democracy, again, in the ideal, power is at least somewhat decentralized. Everyone shares power to some extent, and then we can use our technologies to collaborate, to cooperate, to show empathy to one another, to help one another. Because in a cooperative society, in a high trust society, when we help each other, we all benefit. As opposed to a growth at any cost, might is right, power and money are the only metrics society that big tech is trying to encourage us to adopt. So again, the exploitation in tools happens a lot, but we can resist. We can resist, look for ways to build trust, to build cooperation, to build empathy. And finally, Michelle with one L, our very own from WFMU, writes, I've been reading about gender and racial bias becoming a problem in AI programming. I think it's an interesting topic for discussion, and I agree, Michelle, and I'm just about out of time, but I do have a pointer. A few months ago, I had on the show Meredith Broussard, who has been on the show twice now, but her most recent book is More Than a Glitch. And we didn't get to this in the interview, so you wouldn't hear this if you went back to the archives to listen to my interview with Meredith Broussard. But in the book, More Than a Glitch, Meredith Broussard writes, this is in chapter 10, about algorithmic auditing. So the good news is there is some awareness now about the gender and racial bias that can be built in to algorithms. And there's now something called an algorithmic audit that can try to detect if there is any bias built into the logic or the data of an algorithm before it's launched. It's really good. And there, and Broussard talks about Kathy O'Neill, who's doing some work on audits, and there are other companies out there. So we're ending on some good news. So yes, there has been a history of gender and racial bias in algorithms, but it has gotten awareness through the good work of people like Meredith Broussard and other researchers and journalists. And there are people out there trying to do something about it. And again, go read More Than a Glitch if you're interested in more. That's all the time I have this evening. Thanks again to all the listeners who sent in questions. And I plan to have a full-length interview for you next week. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Until next time, friends, you know what to do. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, friends, whatever you do, get off Google. Have a great week.
You're allowed to pop up windows. Page will not load. Resolving host, giving up the ghost. No problem solved. wanted to download. Error found, account gone to ground. Unlearned. Some cloud we later disavowed. The civil dead. You should have crowdsourced your neurosis, where moral panic never sleeps. Surveillance state of pure exhausted hate.
And that's my cue. Welcome, everybody, to another exciting installment of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. I'm Dave Mandel, your host. I bring you this exciting show every Monday evening at the hour, at between the hours of 7 and 8 p.m., following hot on the heels of Mark Hurst's Tectonic program. Welcome. We're going to start today's show with something from a Belgian group. Can I find it? I wasn't exactly prepared, but it's here, somewhere nearby. I can't find it. All right. Let's go with plan B. And we will hear something from a Swedish guy named Bo Hansson, some of you may be familiar with, not as relatively well-known. Relative. These things are all relative. He was active, well, the record we're going to hear is from the 70s, early 70s. He was active that early on. He is Swedish, recorded for the Silence record label, which has come up, I think, a couple times in the last few shows, hasn't it? Silence, great Swedish label that released many prog rock and prog-y albums in the 70s and 80s, Silence Records out of Sweden. Bo Hansson is a keyboardist, and multi-instrumentalist. And you will hear on this track, if I'm not mistaken, some mellotron playing. Always good news. A tasty piece, I would say, from Bo Hansson. This is going to be a track called Divided Reality from a 1972 album called Magician's Hat.